We'll hear oral argument now in the case of Jaskolski against Daniels.
Oh, my God.
Mr. Say.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, this case, the issues in this case revolve around the trial court's interpretation of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E, and the Daniels contend and have contended that 6E does not apply to Mr. Jaskolski or to the NICB, so it doesn't apply to the individuals in the case, and also it does not apply to the situation in the case, that is, to the request from a private investigator working for a private investigation agency for private materials. In essence, Your Honors, 6E does not apply to these plaintiffs. 6E applies to a limited class of individuals who are bound to secrecy. Individuals that have to do with grand jury proceedings.
What do you mean it doesn't apply to these plaintiffs? I assume that you're saying that it doesn't apply because, in your view, Jaskolski was not acting as a government employee at the time?
That's right, Your Honor.
But why does that matter? What rule 6E2B little... I lose track of all of these subsections. But what the subsection seems to say is that if the information was disclosed under a particular subsection, then it can't be redisclosed without permission of the court. And is there any doubt that the information was disclosed under that subsection on the assumption he was an employee, right or wrong? And it doesn't look like, you see my point, it doesn't look like the statute, the structure of the rule, calls for a decision on whether he was or was not an employee. It calls for a decision on what subsection of the rule was the basis for the disclosure.
If, in fact, there was a disclosure, and I don't believe that there's any evidence of record that any private information was disclosed to Mr. Jaskolski. But Your Honor, I think to address, I think I know what you're asking to address the core of your question. 6E also has a section 6E2, I believe, that says that if you're not one of these within one of these classes, a court reporter, a grand juror, et cetera, and the phrase in the rule that you refer to, Your Honor, or an employee of the government to whom an attorney for the government made a disclosure, then you're not bound to secrecy. And the issue...
No, that's not what it says. It says if the information was not disclosed under one of these subsections, you're under no duty of secrecy. Right? That's the leap you're making from whether it was disclosed under a particular subsection to whether somebody was an employee. Let me give you another example. Suppose there's an assistant U.S. attorney. Everybody agrees that Jones is an assistant U.S. attorney. He's conducting a case before a grand jury. He resigns on Thursday to go into private practice. But as a courtesy, he presents a last bit of evidence to the grand jury on Friday. Right? In your view, could he then go and tell the world what he had told the grand jury on Friday, because on Friday he was not any longer a federal employee, even though the only reason he got the information was because of his role?
Well, but the rule would clearly apply to Jones because he was an attorney for the government at the time that any information was
not on Friday, not on my hypothetical.
Well, on Friday, if information were disclosed to Jones and he's no longer a U.S. attorney, the rule, as we read it, Your Honor, would not apply to Jones.
Look,
why? How do you, where do you get there in the rule?
Okay.
Right, I've been emphasizing the language of the rule. You haven't discussed it. You might want to discuss the actual language of the rule.
Well, Your Honor, the rule lists, several classes of individuals. One of them you just mentioned, an attorney for the government. Another is a government employee who has had information shared with him by an attorney for the government. And I guess what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that...
One more time. I don't want to keep my colleague from asking questions.
That's okay.
The actual rule, and I've now looked up all these blasted subsections, it's 6E2B7. After listing an attorney for the government, et cetera, it says 7, VII, a person to whom disclosure is made under Rule 6E3A, little 2 or little 3.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It doesn't say a person to whom disclosure was made correctly under that rule. It just says a person to whom disclosure is made under that rule. And I take it there's no serious doubt that that was the rule that was invoked to justify these initial disclosures.
Well, Your Honor...
How do you read that language?
I read it like this. There was... I suppose there's an allegation that some information was disclosed to this person, which was secret information. I don't think that that's of record. But I guess what I'm saying is that it's impossible. It's logically and factually impossible that Mr. Jaskowski could have had information disclosed to him as a government employee because he never was.
I'm asking you how you read particular language. I have so far been utterly unable to get you to discuss the actual language of the rule. This is your last chance. Do you want to discuss the actual language of the rule?
Yes, Your Honor. And I guess what I'm saying is reading that in those words, giving them their common ordinary meaning, if he was not an attorney or a transcriptionist or an employee of the government, and there was never any evidence that he was, a disclosure couldn't have been made in good faith to him under that rule.
Yes, it could. Judges sometimes make mistakes, right? Your critical move, although you don't seem to want to acknowledge it, is that you want us to add the word correctly or properly to that rule. Now, and then you want to argue whether it is correct or proper. But the initial move is adding the word correctly in that rule. And I wonder whether that is a proper means of construing this statute, because it is a statute.
Well, I think that the statutory construction rule of avoiding an absurd application of the statute, for example, would
nothing
support
remotely
that reading.
Absurd in saying if a district judge makes a mistake and discloses grand jury information that he shouldn't have disclosed, it shouldn't be passed on. That's not an absurd proposition. Anyway, I'm going to quit.
It's just sort of an addendum, I guess, because to me it seems that even if we were to assume that it was, an error of the worst possible sort to have treated Mr. Jaskowski as government personnel for purposes of Rule 6. Mm-hmm. He was given access to grand jury materials on the assumption that he is bound by a duty of secrecy. And wow, what it would do to Rule 6. I mean, how it would undermine Rule 6 and the functioning of a grand jury to say he's under no duty of secrecy. So it just seemed... how concretely are you harmed by proceeding in federal court before Judge Moody? He can sort out what is and what is not grand jury material, and he can also decide the extent to which there is a need to maintain the secrecy of such material, right?
I suppose, Your Honor...
So why come in here and destroy Rule 6?
I don't want to destroy Rule 6, Your Honor, and I suppose that I suppose that sort of moves on to my second point, is that 6E really doesn't apply to this situation. What we're asking for, essentially, is Mr. Jaskowski's recollections as he was conducting his investigation for NICB and for NICB's file contents. And we... Just factual background, Your Honor, in this case, there was disclosure in the criminal proceeding of, I believe, 35 sets of documents pursuant to 35 subpoenas, 15 transcripts of grand jury witnesses, And we're not after that. We don't want Mr. Jaskowski to give us any transcripts of grand jury materials.
How can we even know that? Your discovery requests are framed in the broadest, I mean, the broadest possible terms. I mean, how can we, you know, how can we know this?
I would say, Your Honor, because of two things. One, we've stipulated we don't want any of that material from him. We want NICB's file, not the grand jury transcripts and subpoenas. And so our position is, even if 6E applies, Your Honor, and of course our position is it doesn't, even if it does apply, that the materials, the evidence before the trial court was, this is a gentleman who was never present in the grand jury room, wasn't especially privy to any grand jury secrets, and has a file that he maintained during an investigation that was done at the urging of a private insurance company.
Thank you, counsel.
Your situation does not.
Mr. Vanzo's time now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Vanzo.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Carl Vanzo. I'm here on behalf of Ken and Sharon Daniels, and I want to address only the. I plan on addressing only the third issue in our brief, whether the trial court erred in failing to follow certain procedural matters or requirements in not holding an evidentiary hearing and not making findings of fact. And I really have little to add beyond
what
we've...
The whole point of what the trial judge did was to buck this question to Judge Moody. Why would you need to hold findings of fact to move it to another judge who would actually hold the hearing and then the findings of fact?
Well, the issue that was before Judge Lozano was the issue raised by NICB and Jaskowski in their complaint.
The order in this case is basically a stasis order until we go before Judge Moody and go through everything else. I could understand an argument on your behalf that that order violates the Anti-Injunction Act 2283, but you haven't made that argument. I could understand an argument on your behalf that that order violates the Full Faith and Credit Clause because it denies preclusive effect to the decision of the state court. You're not making that argument. I have an awfully hard time understanding the claim that you have to hold an evidentiary hearing before you send a case to another judge for an evidentiary hearing.
Well, and Your Honor, I don't think that the order contemplates an evidentiary hearing by Judge Moody. But again,
Judge Moody will decide the case using whatever procedures are correct and required.
Well, perhaps a procedural hearing then. But the point I was going to make was that on August 23rd of last year, we attended a hearing that was scheduled to be a hearing on a preliminary injunction on the complaint filed by the NICB, which raises only issues as to Criminal Rule 6. It has nothing to do with whether the materials, well, it only tangentially has to do with whether the materials are actually grand jury matters. That matter has not been established, and that would be certainly something that a party...
decided by Judge Moody. If you're correct that these are not grand jury materials, you will prevail outright before Judge Moody.
But it's not presented yet. Actually, Judge, I don't think it will, because there still hasn't been any evidence presented of what it is that Mr. Jaskowski supposedly learned after he first met with the U.S. Attorney's Office when he stopped testifying in his deposition. We don't know what he did after that point.
Counsel, is any of that necessary? I mean, this follows up on Judge Easterbrook's question. Why is any of that necessary to the resolution of the legal issue that was present here?
I'd only suggest that, as we stated in our appendix, and Mr. Cersic referred to it.
You might have had all the information you want by now if you'd only complied with the injunction rather than spending the last year on appeal.
But we weren't really seeking anything that the grand jury generated. As Mr. Sissick said, we had transcripts.
Then, as my colleague says, you would long ago have won before Judge Moody.
But
the only sense of your appealing instead of just going before Judge Moody is that you must believe you are seeking grand jury materials.
No.
Because otherwise you would have won in a snap in the district court.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but we didn't interpret the order as saying that there would be any interpretation by Judge Moody of what Mr. Jaskolski did during his investigation outside of what grand jury materials we might seek from the grand jury. our interpretation of the order was go to Judge Moody and ask to see whatever grand jury materials you want. The problem is what we're seeking is not grand jury material. Right. It's the information contained held by Mr. Jaskowski.
If you persuade Judge Moody of that, there will be no further federal interference. Go forward in state court. It's all perfectly straightforward.
Well, again, it should have been...
Look, it ought to be clear to you by now, we don't make factual decisions as an initial matter on appeal. The subpoena asked for everything Jaskolski has. Likely that includes grand jury material. This can all be shaken out before Judge Moody in a trice, but courts of appeals do not make factual decisions as an initial matter. So you're...
But
marking up the wrong tree.
Well, we're still facing an injunction, Your Honor, and I think that it's unfair that one judge grants an injunction and tells you to go hold another evidentiary hearing with another judge, when in fact the injunction, our point is that the injunction should not have been granted.
Much, because it doesn't contribute to discussion. That's why I'm surprised that you didn't make a stand on the Anti-Injunction Act 2283 or the Full Faith and Credit Statute 1738. But here we are. You haven't invoked either one.
Well, and quite frankly, Your Honor, I think that our first assessment was that the factual, the underpinnings of the claim that should have been decided by Judge Lozano weren't clear. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Brannett.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
I am a little interested, though, even though your adversary hasn't raised the Full Faith and Credit Statute, I am more than a little interested in what this case is doing in federal court, given Section 1738, given the fact that the state court enforced the subpoena, rejected a grand jury, an argument that was grand jury materials, and given the Supreme Court's holding in the Merisi case, Merisi against American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, almost 20 years ago now, that 1738 applies even when the claim is one that would otherwise be within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts. So what in the world is this case doing in federal court after the state court has already made a decision on this very topic?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the complaint we filed in federal court was filed before the state court
ruled.
It
doesn't make any difference in what order the documents are filed. The question is, in what order were the cases decided?
Your Honor, I can only answer that the issue has not been raised. I believe it's waived.
Well, I'm aware of that. Preclusion's an affirmative defense. It's been forfeited by your adversaries. But they had what appears to be an absolutely lock-solid defense. Once the state court decided under 1738 and Merisi, the federal court should not have proceeded.
Well, the only answer I can give, Your Honor, because I have not researched the issue because it was never raised, is that the injunction in this case is against the parties rather than the court.
That might be a response to the Anti-Injunction Act. It is not a response to the Full Faith and Credit Statute.
I'm going to have to rely on forfeiture, Your Honor.
No, I don't blame you. There was no particular cause for you to research it since your adversary didn't raise it. I was just wondering whether you'd thought about it. Okay.
But all the district court in this case did, as you have pointed out already, is say to the Daniels, if you want discovery of matters that may potentially include grand jury matters, you're going to have to do it in front of Judge Moody. That's all it said. The district court never said that everything that we had constitutes grand jury materials. It just says it may be, and we want Judge Moody to sort that out. And the reason that is, contrary to what they're trying to say here, the Daniels, in essence, are trying to say that grand jury matters include only what happened in the grand jury room itself. And in essence, what they're trying to say is if this argument were a grand jury proceeding, they're trying to say that the only thing that's protected by Rule 6 would be what we're saying right now in this courtroom. This brief, for example, because I prepared it outside of this room, would not be protected by Rule 6. But just like this brief reveals what the arguments that took place in this courtroom are, Mr. Jaskolski's interviews of witnesses who then testified in front of the grand jury obviously would reveal what happened in front of the grand jury. So, and that's exactly what they're trying to get. They admitted on the record that they're trying to get everything that Jaskolski did or said or observed while he was working side by side with the FBI and the U.S. attorney. And that includes witness interviews, and under this court's own precedent, including in the special grand jury case 662 F. Second 1232, those kind of interviews and witness statements and so on are protected, at least potentially, within Rule 6. And the biggest problem here, Your Honor, is that the state court order basically obviates all protections under Rule 6, so everything is fair game here.
Did the state court order include a ruling on the applicability of 6E or no?
It did. The state court order said that there is no need for secrecy anymore. Therefore, all objections based on Rule 6 are overruled, and you have to answer everything without regard to any protections or secrecy under Rule 6. Now, once it's recognized that they are at least potentially seeking grand jury materials, then it follows that the Daniels have no choice but to pursue such discovery in front of Judge Moody. Because the federal court is, as you pointed out, the only court with jurisdiction to make that decision. I don't know whether this is an answer to the Full Faith and Credit Act, or Full Faith and Credit question, but there is tension between that and the statements of the courts that federal courts are the only place that you can get grand jury materials. And, Your Honor, this isn't a question of just exclusive jurisdiction. This is a question of custody and control of these documents as well. And that may be also an additional answer to the full faith question. These documents, this information, is not Jaskolski's. The case law is very clear that this stuff, these matters, are the courts. So we get to fundamental principles here of federalism and two sovereigns. You know, as much as I would want to be able to tell my neighbor to change the color of his house, I can't do that without his approval. And as much as the state court would want to tell the federal courts what to do with its own property, it cannot do that without the federal court's approval. So it's really not just a question of jurisdiction, it's also a question of control. The federal court is not just obeying the state court, it's not just following, giving credit to a state court action order.
You already said that you weren't prepared.
Okay.
If I were you, I would avoid it, because you obviously have never read the Merisi case,
right.
Or if you have, don't remember it.
But it's still, Your Honor, if without regard to full faith, it still is the fact that these matters are within the exclusive custody and control of the federal court. And the mere fact that Jaskolski was there and given those materials, he still had them at the suffrance of the district court. He did not.
Did the U.S. attorney make an appearance in the state court action when this discovery dispute was being litigated?
The U.S. attorney did not appear in that. He did not appear in that. So, in essence, what the state court was trying to do is enjoin the federal court itself by ordering these matters to be disclosed. So the federal court therefore had jurisdiction and indeed the obligation to prevent that from happening, to exercise control over its own materials and jurisdiction. And in the Socialist Workers case versus Grubizik, this court looked at the reverse situation where where litigants came to the federal court to try and get state grand jury matters. And this court recognized that principles of comity and other principles, fundamental principles, required that the question first be presented to the court that had supervision over the grand jury. To get to the heart of this question, Justice Easterbrook pointed out that what they are trying to do.
We're judges here.
You're right. I'm sorry. You reminded me of that the last time I was in front of you. I'm sorry. I think you mentioned that there was no justice in the Seventh Circuit. So, but
some people think that. But we do still have a circuit justice.
The language of Rule 6 is that anybody to whom materials are disclosed under that particular, I get confused about the subsections too, but who is disclosed under that particular subsection, that there is an obligation of secrecy. Judge Jaskolski signed a certification, voluntarily agreed to accept that obligation, and consequently, regardless of whether he was given the materials correctly, he was subject to contempt, and he was subject to the jurisdiction of the federal court, and he had to seek approval of the federal court to disclose those materials, if the court so allows. In essence, what is happening here is that this is a crack. There was a crack in the levy. Even assuming that Mr. Jaskolski is not government personnel, there may have been a crack in the levee. Some water got out to somebody who may not have been entitled to that materials. But the answer to that is not to tear down the levee and get rid of all Rule 6 protection. The answer to that is to contain the damage, to repair the levee. And that is done by ordering Mr. Jaskolski to keep confidentiality as appropriate. And this court's opinion back in the 1950s in the Kane case is exemplary of that. In that case, the grand jury material was disclosed to persons who were not entitled to those materials. And this court at that time said the answer is for the district court to affirmatively act to prevent any further disclosures or erosions of the protections of Rule 6. And that is the appropriate answer here. We would also suggest, Your Honor, that even if you get to the question, that Mr. Jaskolski is and falls within the definition of government personnel. And that is because he was acting, the evidence on this is presented to the district court, and it's undisputed. He was acting under the direction and control of the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI. Now, this court and other courts under older versions of Rule 6 have held that the rule applies to people who are acting under the direction and control of those people specifically listed.
Gee, how do you control somebody who's an independent contractor and not an employee?
Your Honor, a principal can control...
We're here for the last case, I trust.
Pardon? A principal can...
We're here for the prior case.
No, well, I'm not saying that... I did hear your comment in the prior case, Your Honor. You cannot control a sentient being.
You can't control employees either.
Exactly. But that's not the question. The question is, and that may be the wrong term, but the point is that you look at it under agency principles. Did he fit within the definition of an agent? And that's what this court, back in the Stanford case, looked at. At that time, Rule 6 applied only to attorneys, U.S. attorneys. And yet this court found that it was appropriate to disclose information to people who were acting under the direction, and I'll leave it at that, under the direction of U.S. attorneys. And that's exactly what happened here. Mr. Jaskolski didn't do anything without the direction and consent of the U.S. attorney or the FBI in this case. If there are no questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Kapp.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court, David Kapp for the government. Our office may have erred here, Your Honors, in granting Mr. Jaskolski access to grand jury material. That, however, does not need to be decided. That is not the determinative issue. The fact is he got grand jury information, worked with our office and the FBI hand in hand on a lengthy grand jury investigation. Rule 6 and the case law have developed a clear procedure for litigants seeking access to that material. And what Judge Lozano has directed in his order is that the state plaintiffs avail themselves of that procedure. Judge Moody impaneled this grand jury in the Northern District of Indiana, and it is Judge Moody's, it's under Judge Moody's jurisdiction, and it is his determination as to what is and what is not grand jury material. And the reason these procedures are so important is because they frame the issue. While I certainly appreciate the state plaintiff's assertion that they are not seeking grand jury material, the fact is, as Judge Rovner has noted, these are the broadest discovery requests imaginable. Some of the requests want every meeting with the U.S. Attorney's Office, every conversation with the FBI, things like that. And it's the determination of what is or what is not grand jury material is a very difficult determination that turns greatly on the facts of each particular instance. That's why Rule 6 in the case law first require the litigants to precisely define what they're seeking. Once that definition is in play, one can analyze it in the context of the entire grand jury investigation. If we erred, that will be dealt with by Judge Moody. But certainly our conduct, right or wrong, in the U.S. Attorney's Office does not determine the scope of the grand jury secrecy. The district court has a crucial role in that respect, and that's what these procedures are designed to protect. We would urge the court to affirm Judge Lozano's order. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.